I know we talked about some of these questions this morning in our webinar, but we'll just start with question one and go right through them. Question one is, I would like to ask, how do you look for donors? Do you have a personal network? Do you work with a list of references? Do you use a mass flyer in social media or private communications? Do you offer different options with different amounts of money? Or do you just share big projects? So a lot of questions in one right there. But to answer your question, you can use your personal network. However, depending on how often you go back to that, it may not be great. The relationship of a fundraiser belongs with the institution you're fundraising for. And so if you are a professional fundraiser, you shouldn't overreach those bounds. As missionaries, you're not kind of bound quite so hard by the ethical call there, but at the same time, you don't want to push your friends and family away because you're always asking them for money. So a personal network of acquaintances is something you can use, but do so at your own risk and make sure you're asking them for things you know that they'd be happy to be part of. List of references. I think for the institution that you're at or wherever you're at, if there is a list of people that have worked there or connected, that is the best. If there's been somebody that has worked there for a long time, they may be able to give you some ideas on who are some people that have been involved in the past and would like to, be further involved. So use the resources you have. A lot of times there isn't any information, so you may just need to talk with people that have been there or find out when they visit. You know, sometimes you'll get lucky and somebody will stop by a church or a school or hospital or other organization that hasn't been there for a long time, and they may be able to give you some pointers on that. The use of social media, I think we talked about. There's a place for everything. Private communications, obviously, when you're one-on-one, is going to be for larger donations, and those are going to take some time to develop. You have to develop the relationship, and we talk about that in this class. Social media is an easy way to throw a wide blanket that will capture a lot of people that might be interested and maybe help you build a list of people that are interested in your thing. And as far as flyers or newsletters, again, I think in the context of social media, they're great for unless it's a very, very elderly audience. I would not recommend printing a lot of things that you have to mail and other things. There's a lot of cost with it. With social media, it's just free. As far as differing amounts of monies to the donors or different options, if you're working one-on-one with them, through those conversations, you should be able to figure out what they're interested in. If it's something you're putting out on social media, I wouldn't have more than one project in any one post, but you could have, a lot of times they'll recommend like a 3 or 4 giving options, you know, 20, 50, 100, or other, and they can type in their own amount. So those are things that work. There is some psychology that goes into the placement of that and the amounts. So if you want to do a little research on that, you can. But definitely having options available is never a bad thing. And do you share just a big project and then do you just share a big project and then collect for that one? Depends. As an organization, you're going to have more than one thing going on, and it's fine to share all of those things. The most immediate need is the one I would focus on, but the different projects are going to appeal to different people, so you want to make sure it stays in front of them. But again, a social media plan, communications plan would help you decide what's going to happen to that and when, and be a good way to, help you keep a lot of options open for a lot of different people. Okay, question two. Personally, this is the beginning of the question. Personally, this individual doesn't want to fundraise for his family. or for himself as an individual, but would like to raise money for his country or projects that are happening where he's at. And I think the question in there is it wrong to ask for money for yourself? I tend to avoid asking for money for myself. I would avoid that as much as possible. Now, if you're a self-supporting missionary, that's part of what you need to do, and you need to have the reasons why people should support you. I would definitely try and make that as much about others as possible, to help people with that. It's on a case-by-case basis, but there is a fine line between, you know, pushing too hard for yourself and what you're going to use the money on. And when you do raise money, if you are in a self-supporting role, make sure that that money is being stewarded and used the way it should, and not being spent on big cars or other things. I have had some experiences with that, with the individuals that had their own network of donors. They call for money for a project, and then the next thing you know, they would be driving a brand new car. And any time we can avoid the appearances, now it doesn't mean that they did something wrong, but any time we can avoid those type of appearances, I think it's to the best. Okay, question three is, what role can social media play? I think we went over that in our discussion earlier quite well, but it should have a significant role in your fundraising. And you definitely need to think about your communication strategy with it. As much as possible too, pictures and stories are great. We talked about that. But when you can have the individuals that these funds will help telling the story themselves, it works even more so. At the university where I was at, we had a regular feature that we put up where the students would say why they came to the university and what the university meant for them. And having the students share that information as opposed to one of our recruiters or myself really made a big difference in the authenticity of that call. And we saw a lot of better responses during that as well. Okay, question four, what is the best way to get your needs out there? Newsletter, a vlog, a Facebook, how often should you keeping your needs before your donors? Yes to all of those things. The newsletter, I think, especially in the digital context, if you are putting one together already, I will tell you from my personal experience, we had a newsletter that we provided on campus in Thailand there, something that had been done for a long time. And people like to have it around. But when we actually started tracking the amount of use that the printed ones were getting and also what was happening online, where people clicking into it and so forth, and you can track some of that. You can track some of that using, you know, different electronic options. But you can tell who's clicked into it and so forth, and if they're actually reading it. And what we found was there was a lot of good information, there was a lot of effort going into it, but very little use was coming from the newsletters. Whereas if we broke that newsletter down into individual posts, we saw a lot higher return on the effort. So this, not that the idea of a newsletter is bad, but you may look at some more creative ways to get it out there, because if you track things, I think you'll find that not a lot of people are willing to take the time to sit down and look at the whole newsletter, where they may look at one of the stories or they'll pick the one that interests them the most and spend some time with that on social media. Okay, question five is, how do I get contacts around the world to talk to them and try and get them to make donations so that we can continue our work here and reach a sustainable point in our project? You know, fundraising is a slow thing, and we're fortunate that God is looking out for us and is actively involved in what we're doing as missionaries. If you're in a spot where you're needing to fundraise to keep yourself in the mission field and you don't have any contacts, then I would reach out to the people that you do know. I mean, if you sit down and think about it, there'll be a handful anyway, and they may be church employees or whatever, and see if they are invested in what you're doing and if they would be willing to ask their friends. You can just put out something on social media and see what happens. A lot of times, if you come up with a good presentation materials, a good photo, a good video, something that grabs people's attention, or really make a strong case for your cause, if you can get it to go viral, who knows who might support you. But if you're just looking for doing the legwork, it just starts with asking people that may be involved in the area or in the work, if they know of people that would be interested in supporting, trying to get those connections, or starting from scratch with social media and trying to build your audience, and then trying to identify within that audience those people that you can kind of target for giving. Not everyone on social media is going to want to give. But you can with boosting and stuff. For example, Facebook and Instagram both are great with this. You can boost your posts. You can see who's interacting with them. And you can grow your audience. We went from 200 people on our Facebook page with Asia Pacific International University to over 18,000. We had some ebbs and flows when we made concentrated efforts to bring in new likes. We were successful with that. But over a period of about 3.5 years, we added 18,000 people. So it can be done, and it can happen quickly. You can go from 200 to 2,000 or 10,000 quite quickly with a little bit of effort and a little bit of money in the boosting. And when I say little, I do mean little. Most posts you can boost for $3. And especially if it's just a picture and so forth, that'll work real well. But I wish you luck. I know it's not an easy thing. It takes work, and you have many other things to do as well, but you have to just start somewhere. I would recommend social media and people that you know that are somehow connected that might be able to make other connections for you. All right, question 6 is, how do you handle an audience in your mission field that may have been destroyed by the donor syndrome, that they think someone will come and do the work for them, even when you know there's potential for them to do the work themselves? And how can you motivate them? I think we talked about that in our conference, in our webinar earlier today. But I think it comes down to a training and trying to get them involved, and so they can see the successes and start to feel like they can do it themselves, I think is the gist of what I would recommend in that. But there's going to have to be some education that comes along with that. Okay, question 7 is there a way to contact Ryan? I think my email address is being provided to you with this. I'll happy to do what I can. I for larger projects, I'm happy to give advice on small things or whatever I have time to do. I'll do everything I can. And if you're looking to hire somebody, then we can talk about that as well. But really, just have a heart for the mission of this. And if I can help, I will help in any way possible. It may just be encouragement, maybe all I can give, but I'll do what I can. Question 8 is, how do you proceed if you don't have enough funds to finish the basic project that you started? An example might be a school that you're only able to put a foundation for big enough for 2 classrooms. But it looks like you're not able to get the money to finish the building. Do you start the building project? This is something you need to talk over very clearly with your organization and with the administrators involved. what the possibilities are. In some cases, I would say the answer is yes. You don't have to have all the money to get going, but you do need to know that it is coming in. Or you just do it in stages. So you fundraise and you get the foundation that's big enough for two classrooms, but you don't build the building. And then the next year you say, hey, we've got the foundation and now we need to move on to doing the classrooms. You can break it up into stages like that. There's nothing wrong with it. So each one's going to be a little bit different, but you do need to talk with your organization and you guys need to have a plan for that. If you have received money from donors, you need to keep letting them know what the situation is and let them know what's going on. Do you have to give the money back? I think as long as the money is going for the project as planned, there's no need to. But if you decide to scrap that project, then you probably ought to have the hard conversation with the donors about returning the funds or moving their designation towards another project. Okay, question 9 and 10 seem to be the same question, so we'll deal with them together. How do you deal with an organizational leader or leaders that are not respecting the donors' requests for the donations? I guess two things with that. Not all donations are restricted. If you're asking for donations for general operations, those unrestricted donations can be used for whatever the board or whatever the governing body is designates. And it's a great way. Universities and schools will a lot of times have annual funds. Annual funds generally will go to general operation. Operations will decide that they'll go to fund this project or that project, and you let everyone know what's going on with that. In the case where it's a restricted donation and there is a reason, there is a specific project that money should be used for, yes, the money should be offered for return, or try and find, better yet, try and find another project that would be similar. In the case where you have no control over it and the leaders are spending the money differently, or somebody else is making a decision to spend the money differently and without concern for the donors, which, depending on the culture you come from and you're working in, you know, that can go both ways as to what's acceptable and what's not. So that's something I personally take very seriously. I would not fundraise for an individual that's not going to use the money the way that they're requested to use. If they're the ones going to make the final decision and you're not going to have any control over it, then I would not fundraise for that, or find a way to take the control out of their hands. You know, the General Conference has ways you can give through them, and the money can be sent directly for a project, so that the money's not just sitting in the coffers somewhere ready to be spent by somebody else. But it is a serious ethical concern, especially for our Western donors. But I think everywhere in the world, when somebody gives something, they want to know it's going for what it's supposed to be going for. And unfortunately, sometimes people will make decisions they think are in the best interest because it helps an immediate need, not thinking that they're not honoring the donor's wishes. So that is something that's very serious. And if you find yourself in that, again, I think some training can go a long ways, some education for the individuals on why it's important. And there's a lot of stuff out there online. If you Google it, there's a lot of stuff dealing with the ethical use of restricted funds. In the U.S., and they take it seriously enough that an organization can lose its 501c status. Its 501c3 status is what the IRS gives organizations that are allowed to operate as nonprofit and can collect donations and give charitable giving receipts. And so if you're not using the money the way your donors think the money should be used, or what they get, are not using it for the projects they're giving to, really just a simple complaint and a little bit of investigation, and you're organization will lose its status and ability to give those charitable donation receipts. So it's a pretty serious deal, and it has to do with trust. And you have to have trust with the people you're fundraising with and for in order for it to work. And if it's not, you got to step back and see if you can fix the situation or get things moved around so that the people that are a problem are not doing that anymore, or that they, you know, change the tune and can are willing to accept some guidance and, you know, change the way they're dealing with restricted giving. Okay, question 11 is, what can you do in countries where you cannot show most of the work that you're doing? That does pose a problem because people give to things that they can see. That's something I don't have a good answer for, unfortunately. But if you can't show what you're doing, I think it becomes very difficult to do fundraising, or you have to rely only on one-on-one, which means hopefully you have a list of names of people that you can work with. And then you can talk one-on-one with individuals without necessarily having lots of extra materials or things that you're leaving that might incriminate or show something that's going to get you or your organization or somebody else in trouble or hurt or something like that. If you can work with an existing NGO that's willing to work with you to accept funds on your behalf, that's great. But definitely if you know, the nature of what you're doing is not accepted by the country you're in, then I would definitely avoid social media and other things that are going to get you in trouble, because they are monitoring it for sure. And it's not worth risking the mission over a few dollars. So difficult situation. I don't know that I have a great answer for that, but definitely something that we need to look into a little bit further. Question 12, culture impacts how donors give. Can you discuss some differences between West and East donors? I think we talked about that one in our webinar as well, but they are different. The World Giving Report is a great way to see how people in your country are interacting and giving, and what any insights might be from that World Giving Report. I believe we'll have a link for the latest one up with this webinar, so you can take a look at it and see what your country or the country you're serving in, where it ranks and stacks up on what's going on there. A lot of it has to do just with cultural differences and communication styles. You know, is it an honor shame culture? You know, how do you approach the donor sometimes? And this is the same actually in the U.S., but in Thailand, we worked with a family, and that family, actually the daughter was the one running the business, so to speak, day to day. Mom and dad were older, but the request in order to be even heard needed to go through the father. And so understanding that, and that just comes with asking a few questions, kind of observing, but the general cultural play that you see or in your day-to-day work, wherever you're at, will help you, you know, understand that a little bit better. In the U.S., there's a lot more research on it and a lot of different things that you can do. Fundraising is well understood in the U.S. Other countries in the world, especially in the eastern areas, fundraising is not as well understood. So it becomes a little bit of an education there as well on why it's important and what it can do. In Singapore, there was a joint venture between the National University of Singapore and Yale University. And I happen to know one of the fundraisers for that. Yale came with the idea that they needed to fundraise and set up this Yale NUS venture with some fundraisers. And it really took a good 10 years before they started really making any headway. The lady I know that worked there said after 10 years, they were starting to understand, the feeling was more positive on the fundraising side of things when they were approached, when they were asked to give or provided with fundraising materials. But in a lot of countries, especially with education or hospitals, these are seen as for-profit endeavors and are not, things that make money, and so therefore you don't need to give to. So if you find yourself in one of these, you probably understand that already, but just be aware. If you are in a church organization or something where you're working with the needy, then that can be a different story. But if you're in some sort of organization that might be seen as for-profit, that will definitely hamper your ability to work within that culture. And we'll just take some thoughtful communications and marketing to get people internally with the organization or with the area that you're working at, the community that you're working at, and externally through social media to help people understand exactly why it's important to give. Question 13 is, how can I use social media if I cannot publish pictures and real names of those being helped? I don't think there is anything wrong with staged photographs if they convey the nature of what was happening. If you definitely don't want to put anyone in danger, and if you can use some stage, if you can do the staging yourself and be part of that, or if you can, sometimes you can purchase or download images to use for free. You might even be able to make some requests. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. If you have a story, changing names definitely is okay. You don't want to embarrass anyone or put anyone at risk of anything. So the name thing is easier to deal with. The picture thing, you just got to figure out what that image is and then go try and find the best one. Make sure you have the rights to the image and that you can use it legally, especially if you're using social media, because that can get you into trouble. A lot of things in the news here lately, especially in the U.S., where celebrities have been using posts, pictures of themselves on social media that were taken by paparazzi or the press, and they're being sued because they don't have rights to that photograph, even though the photograph is of them. So it's something that the social media platforms take seriously, and they'll take it down and block you and even risk losing the status of your page if they see that you're doing something wrong. And so you want to avoid that at all costs. But definitely staging images, canned images, and changing names is fine. Convey your story as best you can while protecting those that you're there to serve. Okay, question number 14. Our sending organization is recommending that we attend a fundraising training offered by Support Raise Solutions. This will cost a lot of money and travel and take up some time. Is it worth it, basically, is what you're asking. I'm not familiar, and I'd be happy to do a little research into the Support Raising Solutions. The one that I'm familiar with that I would recommend to everyone is it's called the Fundraising School, and it is headquartered at the Lilly School of Philanthropy at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. It's a mouthful. But they offer a certificate in fundraising management. The first course that you take is a foundational course called Principle and Techniques of Fundraising. It goes through a lot of really great stuff. The price is not necessarily cheap. However, I know all of their courses are available as online courses, and they do provide support through online channels as well. So you can, if you have some budget allowed for the training, you could actually take the training online and move through their courses and not have to deal with the travel as well, which would save some funds. Now, you might have caught that the location is in Indianapolis, and we have a GC session coming up next summer in Indianapolis, and so there may be some opportunity there. We'll do a little research and see if maybe a principle and techniques class could be offered during the GC session while we're down there. If there's interest in that, we may be able to work with the General Conference to help get that offered, especially for missionaries that are there attending. The principles and techniques is a full 5-day course. So it's a longer one, and then the other 3 or 4 modules that you'll take to complete the certificate are quite a bit shorter, 2 to 2.5 days tops. But principles and techniques of fundraising from the fundraising school is definitely well worth it, and I would definitely look into that before you spend any money on support raising solutions, because it is a great asset. Okay, question 15 is, in the name of who do you collect money in countries that you cannot mention that you represent a Christian church or movement? I think we talked about that a little bit too, but find an organization you can work with if you're collecting locally. Find one, an existing NGO, or find a way to create an NGO for yourself that you can use. You don't want to be on the wrong side of the law on this, so make sure you're staying in. Now, if you're in another country collecting money from a different country when you visit back home or whatever, or on your travels, probably less of concern. But when you're local, you do need to be careful. And if it's not allowed, it's not allowed. I would not put yourself at risk over it. But if you can find an NGO that you can work with, then definitely do that, or start one yourself that is outside of the religious spectrum, but still lets you maybe deal with humanitarian or other issues that you'd like to deal with. Additionally on that, best practice, best case is always collecting in the name of the organization that you are there representing. You're not just personally asking. You're asking on behalf of the organization. That's just a side note to what I said earlier, but the relationship and the ask does belong to the institutions that we represent. Okay, question 16, how do you manage soft information in fundraising? For example, refugees in the Middle East. I'm not sure if I'm understanding that one exactly, soft information. I think if you're asking, do you share their names, there's no need to do that. Make up names, don't give them names, whatever the case may be. We want to protect, when it comes to our donors, we also want to protect our donors' information. And when it comes to, especially if you're dealing with refugees or with children or other things, you don't want to put them at risk or give donors too much access to them or put them in a spot where somebody online might see it. So document control, that comes from my manufacturing background, but handling the documents properly, making sure that you're protecting them, should be forever in your mind as you're dealing with this. You definitely want to make sure that you're protecting those that you're there to serve. And if you can't share their information, please don't, but you can find ways around that. Okay, number 17 is an easy one. This webinar, will it be 1 or 2 hours? And the answer to that is the webinar was 1 hour, as we all found out at the 1 hour mark. I think 18 is a suggestion that a future webinar would be recommended with the GC Office of Adventist Mission, and how the mission offerings work their way through the Adventist Church system, how they get there. I think that's a great idea. It is a little bit of a complicated system. It's an even harder thing to get approved for a special offering. A lot of times, the missions, the local churches, the missions, the unions will not support processing up to the division and the GC, projects at smaller institutions. So, that is something. How can your organization benefit from that, and how is the money actually used? How does it get back to the intended use of that mission offering? I think it's a great idea for another webinar. Number 19, what's the best practice for missionaries to work with their mission administration to help raise funds? Can you give 10 examples? I don't know if I'll get to 10, but you definitely need to work with your mission representatives, whether they're at the mission, the union, the division, a calling organization within any of those. Work with the people that you need to. Find out what's needed. If they have a need, if you're willing to fundraise for, then you definitely want to ask what the needs are. Find out who the stakeholders are and how the communications needs to go. You can have some conversations with people that kind of get you really fired up and ready to do it, but maybe you need to go further up the chain to actually get the approvals if you want the project to go anywhere. So just be aware of kind of the politics of that and how to work with it. You know, these are our mission presidents and treasurers, our union officers, our division officers, everyone. Really, we share the same goal, but when we come down to our work as missionaries, it may not be their priority. Sometimes you have to step back and let something go, and you know, prayer definitely helps out in that. But communication goes a long way. If you can find who the key person is you need to communicate with, pass that information along. Make sure everyone knows if you come, like in Thailand, a lot of times direct communication wouldn't necessarily be the best, but they would, like if somebody wasn't happy with or had an idea, wasn't happy with me or had an idea for something to do that was under my purview, I wouldn't necessarily hear it from them, but they would tell somebody else and maybe even tell somebody else that would eventually get back to me. So the communication styles definitely play a big part in how that goes. I know we didn't get to 10, but I think the key to working with missionaries, working with their mission administration, is to communicate, prayerfully communicate. We have strong feelings, especially if you come from a conflicting culture where communication happens differently or things are happening differently. Try not to get frustrated. Pray for guidance and just communicate as openly as you can. And if it's not working, then be okay either changing your tact or moving on to something else. But don't keep, I think a phrase in English, don't keep beating a dead horse. You're not going to get anything from that. You know, if it's done, it's done. Maybe think of a different way to communicate it or a different way to go around. Try not to go around individuals if it's going to get you grief or get you in trouble. We're there to help serve the communities we're in, and we need to figure out how to function within the structure that we're given. That doesn't always work, but we do our best to make sure that it can. So I hope this has helped some. I know listening to my voice for 45 minutes is probably no one's idea of fun, but thanks for sticking with us and look forward to working with and talking with some of you guys in the future. Wish you all the best. God bless.